Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, April 14th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. It's been a little more than 5 months since Lyndon LaRouche issued a clear and direct warning that the British Empire, through its puppet U.S. President Barack Obama, was using a series of manufactured crises in the Middle East to launch World War III. Though the battleground seemed to be Syria and Iran, the real targets have been Russia and China. And the danger was real that once war began, it would immediately escalate into a thermonuclear war. In these last 5+ months, the LaRouche movement internationally has mobilized representatives of leading institutions and the citizens at large to make them aware of this danger. And I would say it's not an exaggeration to say that thanks to this mobilization, key networks internationally, including at the top levels of the U.S. military and intelligence community, have intervened, and thus far, the war pushed by the British Empire has not yet begun. I think it's also worth noting, and we'll be discussing this today, that this mobilization has significantly increased the impact of the LaRouche movement internationally. And I'll just cite three instances in the last 48 hours on this. The first is another level of breakthrough in France with the campaign of our collaborator Jacques Cheminade, with a series of television interviews that have put Nicolas Sarkozy on the spot. Secondly, a dialogue that took place between Lyndon LaRouche and leading Russian intellectuals that is on this whole question of the relationship between the extraterrestrial imperative and solving the crises we have on the Earth. And third, on the popular Alex Jones radio network, an Impeach Obama video. And the thing that all three of these breakthroughs have in common is they identify the role of the British Empire as the enemy of the United States. And I think this is very significant in terms of what we're going to be discussing today. So on the program today, we're going to be hearing from one of the leaders of this mobilization to stop the war from happening. And of course, at the same time, besides an anti-war mobilization, which in itself can be impotent, identifying both the fundamental cause for the war, that is the genocidal insanity of the British Empire, which is faced with the global collapse of its bankrupt financial system, and secondly, offering a solution to this crisis. And this mobilization has been building an unmistakable resonance in Europe, as I mentioned in France, and also in the United States, which we will discuss with our guest today. So I'm very happy to welcome back to the program Helga Zepp LaRouche.
Yeah, hello. Good afternoon.
Hi, Helga. Now, in the last days, we've seen a heightened level of crisis in three major hotspots, you might say, all of which are really one hotspot. But the hysteria over North Korea's attempt to launch a rocket, as well as the so-called ceasefire in Syria and the threats to Iran. So I don't want us to lose sight of this global strategic threat, and I'd like to begin with your assessment of where things stand today regarding the danger of World War III.
Well, I think that danger remains until the underlying causes for this danger have been removed. So I think that while there is a tremendous effort to get a diplomatic solution for the Syria crisis, with obviously ongoing efforts to undo that from the side of British-directed networks through Qatar, through Saudi Arabia, in part through Turkey, I think that the situation in Iran remains also, you know, terribly hot, despite the fact that naturally this weekend the big conference in Istanbul starts with the group of 5+1 trying to get a negotiated settlement there, and naturally with the failed rocket launch in North Korea, that is also sort of in limbo. But, you know, if you look beyond all of these particular situations, I think that the fact that the world financial system, and there in particular the transatlantic part of it, is about to blow for good, people should not lessen their attention concerning the war danger simply because, you know, it doesn't look totally explosive at this moment, because it is. It is because the system is really coming down. And we have been talking about that for a long period of time. But I think that the end of the rope has been reached. The euro is detonating. The euro is not going to last a long time. And I think we will see developments between now and, I would say, at most May, where dramatic things will bring up the question of either an uncontrolled chaotic collapse or a solution in the direction of a Glass-Steagall credit system. But we are right now in a completely explosive situation, because while the governments of Europe all know that something big is coming, a big explosion is about to occur, they are trying like absolutely hysterically to get over the date of the French election, the first round of which is April 22nd.
Yeah, next week and from tomorrow.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the second round is 2 weeks later. So there is a total scrambling going on to try to not have the Spain issue explode before that date, because, you know, that could impact the French election campaign. And, you know, while Sarkozy is clearly trying to defend the present bailout policy, the ESM, the fiscal union, the debt brake, Hollande has a slightly different policy, not very much different, but, you know, there is a tremendous ferment at the base of the Socialist Party, so that Hollande, from the standpoint of the oligarchical financial forces, is not as secure a bet than Sarkozy. And then you still have, as a extremely important and potent factor in the French election campaign, the campaign of Jacques Cheminade, who has managed not only to be a full-fledged presidential candidate of 10 with equal TV time now in the hot phase of the campaign and equal media time, but who has, because he is the only one who is addressing the real issues, the collapse of the system, how to create an alternative, how to get out of the crisis. He's the only one who's not for the debt brake and who is denouncing the austerity policy. And he has done such a extremely successful and intelligent and brilliant campaign that he definitely is, you know, maybe not at the level of Sarkozy and Hollande, because, you know, obviously that would be a gigantic jump. But he has definitely squeezed himself into the category of an extremely serious candidate. And given the fact that we are in the middle of the breakdown, and 1 week in such periods is a very long time,
right,
I do not exclude even bigger breakouts to come.
Well, Helga, in the last 48 hours, there were two of the most highly watched television news programs in France, where Jacques was able to directly confront Sarkozy. In one case, they played a video of him challenging Sarkozy on the question that Sarkozy said the crisis is over. The other one, Sarkozy apparently somewhat sarcastically mentioned he had just had the pleasure of hearing from Jacques Cheminade, and he hasn't heard the last. But I want to just pick up a couple of things on what you're saying on the European situation, because while you point out the governments have to know that the crisis is not under control, but what we're seeing now is a growing underlying ferment, which is even on the verge of explosion in Germany. Can you just give a picture of how that's... I mean, I was just really struck today that in the Bundestag, they had to issue some kind of decree that you cannot speak on the microphone on debates unless the party approves it. So obviously they're fearful of a breakout.
Well, I think that what you see on that front is a very obvious attempt, both in the United States and also in Europe, to completely do away with not only democracy, with parliamentarian process, but to really undo all the accomplishments which we have really gained, I would say, with the emergence and fight of the sovereign nation state, the representative system where voters are represented through their elected official, social systems, the division of the legal, of the executive, the legislative and the judicative, all of these things which have been tremendous efforts or, you know, accomplishments trying to come to the modern society, they are being undone right now. And what is so breathtaking is how little notice is taken of it. That, you know, while in the United States you have all this, you know, process going in the direction of the Carl Schmitt kind of emergency law as the basis of ruling, the same is really applied and tried with the European Stability Mechanism and the Fiscal Union in Europe, which would totally eliminate national sovereignty, the right over the own budget but on the side of the parliament. And now this elimination of the right to speak of dissidents in the parliament, right, is just one more step in this direction. I find this a complete outrage. I mean, that it's a violation against the Constitution, because in Article 38 of the Grundgesetz, it says that the representative is only responsible to his own conscience. Mm. And in that sense, the party faction discipline, which naturally rules everyday politics, is actually already unconstitutional. But if they now go one step further and say that, you know, if the many dissidents against the ESM cannot speak because, you know, if they don't have faction approval, I mean, this is really in the direction of a dictatorship. And I hope that there will be people suing in the Constitutional Court against it, because it is a violation of the presently existing Grundgesetz. And the fact that it's being pushed just shows you the mind of the people who are doing it, that they really want to go back to, I would say, the undemocratic forms as they existed in the feudal society, I would say before the 15th century, where you have a small oligarchical elite and masses of populations which do not participate in the government at all. And, you know, because if this ESM would ever be voted on, and that's what is being tried now in all European countries to get it through the parliaments, to get it ratified, if that ever would come into being, you would have a complete atrocity. For our listeners here, I should probably say shortly what this ESM is.
Sure.
It's basically the idea to replace the previous bailout mechanisms, you know, which had bailed out Greece and Italy and Ireland and whatnot, to replace all of that with a permanent bailout mechanism. And, you know, this would then have a governor's board, which would be the finance ministers, working together with a directorate, which would be non-elected people. I mean, here you have a case not like the American judges, but really, you know, people from the area of the banking sector.
Well, Helga, don't we already have that with the Papademos dictatorship in Greece and Monti in Italy, where they're non-elected, they're not members of parties, they were essentially imposed by the
EU? Yeah, but this would go a big step beyond that, because okay, you would have a supranational structure, this directorate, which would be immune from legal prosecution. Their wages, the height of their wages would not be known. They never could be you know, investigated by any state attorney. So even if this thing would be completely clean at this point, one of the Italian citizens' initiative who is fighting against it has recently made the correct point that this is like a complete invitation to the mafia, because if you have an area which is a complete lawless realm, if the mafia is not yet in there, then they say, oh, fine, because these directors would have the right, for example, to go on the primary and secondary markets to speculate with the funds of the ESM, you know, for maximum profitability. So, you know, if they would commit fraud, if they would commit stupidity, if they are incompetent, nothing of that could be investigated. And, you know, it's opening up, you know, Europe for the vultures completely. Now, this is an insane policy, and combined with the so-called debt brake, which would be the idea of riding the debt brake, i.e. a balanced budget in all constitutions, it's the worst combination. It would combine austerity policy in the tradition of Brüning from the early 30s in Germany, you know, with totally depressive effects on the real economy, with the limitless ability of this directorate to demand from the households, from the budgets of the member states, unlimited resources at any moment without the ability of national parliaments to oppose it, or even national governments to oppose it. So this is a complete atrocity, and I think everybody who is in their right mind understands that the combination of brutal austerity plus money pumping into the banking sector, causing hyperinflation, is the worst combination, and it would mean the death of Europe if it gets through.
Well, there was a report out this week on the degree to which the money has been pumped in, and it reported that the European banks are presently leveraged at a rate of 26 euros for every euro of assets. And, of course, the euro of assets are questionable also. But the ECB, the European Central Bank, is leveraged 36 to 1. And keep in mind that when Lehman collapsed in 2008, it was a 30 to 1 leverage. So they're demanding that these governments collect the money to cover this level of indebtedness.
Yeah, and it will not happen. I think we are at the point of a breakdown, because, you see, the idea was to replace the European Financial Stability Fund with the European Stability Mechanism, the ESM. And that was supposed to go into effect sometimes the 1st of July. I mean, this was pulled up from 2013. And it has to be ratified by essentially all governments until then. Now, I think this is not going to happen, because now the Spain state bond issue has come back fully. The Spanish banks are in a desperate situation. They had to borrow in March 316 billion euro from the EZB. I mean, the present total sum in the ESM is supposed to be somewhere around 800 billion. So if only Spain has money demand in 1 month of these kinds of sums, you get a sense that this is not going to function. Now, there is a complete panic over that, because if Spain applies for a bailout, even if the ESM would be ratified already, the present monies in the ESM are by far not enough. So you would have to put more money in. And then I think the social consequences, the trade unions in all of southern Europe are already in a general strike in Greece, in Italy, in Spain, in Portugal. The only referendum scheduled so far against that is coming up not on the ESM, but on the debt brake on the 31st of May.
For Ireland.
But they say that nobody can get money from the ESM who has not ratified the debt brake. So, you know, I think this thing is unraveling, and I think we are going into a week. Look at Monday, what will happen to the markets, because, I mean, there is all these extreme worries about China, about the US, about Spain. And then you have, this is really very, very interesting, this scandal which broke out, where Jacques Cheminard basically was the first of the presidential candidates to point attention to it, namely that the German-Swiss derivative firm, Eurex, which is one of the largest in the world, strangely enough, decided to issue from Monday onward, from the 16th of April onward, futures on French state debt with a leverage factor of up to 20. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing which is so ominous about it is that, you know, normally when you have these kind of future options on state debt, then, you know, it starts with 10 million because it only is supposed to include so-called institutional investors.
Hedge funds and private equity funds, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And this time, the entry sum is only 100,000 euro, which means any medium-sized speculator can already bet on the collapse of the French state debt. Now, Jacques immediately put out a statement on April 9th saying this is a complete assault on the French state. This just proves why you need to have the immediate implementation of Glass-Steagall, of a separation of the banks to make such speculative attacks impossible. And, you know, he said this is either an effort to, you know, basically be in the advantage of Sarkozy or, since Hollande is up in the polls right now, to basically make a warning shot to tell him, look, if you dare to go against the financial sector, we can bring down the French economy in no time. So this is developing into a big scandal because now all the so-called candidates from the left have picked up the issue. And, you know, this is now really an issue. You know, I mean, the German government obviously has no power over Eurex. But it just underlines the fact that if these governments continue to refuse to have any reining in of these operations, you know, it leads to a conflict between Germany and France, nevertheless. And in any case, given the extreme nervousness in the situation, all the relevant players and governments are trying to hold this thing together by hook or by crook, until after the French election.
Well, and this is what you mean. This is what you mean when you talk about the crash of the transatlantic system. That there's so many potentials here that there's no way they can hold it together, and they're trying to do it just for another week here and there.
Yeah, and you know, in a certain sense, everybody knows this thing is untenable. We are talking to all kinds of you know, people who agree with us. On the Glass-Steagall, who are in part are people who are well positioned also in the financial sector, because it's not the case that all bankers are against Glass-Steagall. Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, there is a very large group of about 40 French economists and other VIPs who just about 2 weeks ago made a full advertisement in the French papers calling for a return to the policies of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Glass-Steagall, the Pecora Commission, you know, the New Deal, saying that now the you know, policies of Roosevelt are what is the only hope to solve the situation. So we are talking to these people in every country, in Italy, in Scandinavia, in continental European countries, and there is a general understanding that the big explosion is about to occur very soon.
Helga, would you say then that it's fair to say that we're seeing a dramatic shift occurring even in Europe in this period? The reality
well,
is hitting?
Well, I think so because, you know, I mean, obviously, I mean, none of these austerity policies function. I mean, the situation in Greece is probably the most heartbreaking because there you can see how a country is being completely destroyed. The unemployment of youth is now above 50%. People are not receiving vital medicines for cancer treatment. Hospitals are closing down. There's the famous case where a 77-year-old pensioner killed himself as a protest against this austerity because he says, with these policies, I cannot continue to live. And he has become like a folk hero of all the people who say that they will not accept this. And there will be now an election on May 6th in Greece. Mm-hmm. And it looks like that no majority can be formed, at least not a majority which would be willing to continue the policies which the Troika had imposed on Greece. So that is May 6th. So if the Greece package falls apart, with the situation in Spain, you know, really becoming the Spain becoming the new Greece, so to speak, and the next, the present government of Spain will be kicked out in a short period of time. I'm absolutely certain of that. They are so crazy. What they just did is to agree to the EU demands to cut more than 25% of their science and research budget. Now, that comes on top of several years of draconian cuts in science and research, so that several generations of scientists have already left Spain because they absolutely have no perspective of work there. And therefore, you have now a rebellion of the Science Association of of Spain, together with the deans of universities, the trade unions, the Young Scientists Organization, all writing an open letter to the government saying this is absolutely the destruction and end of Spain. And that shows you more than anything else what is the intention of this present EU policy. Because if they had the intention to you know, do something to get the Spanish economy back on, you would increase your investment in basic research and development. You know, you would say we need more areas where Spain can become competitive in the world market, if you want to argue it was in the case of the existing monetary system. But you would say we have to upgrade the productivity of the Spanish economy so that they eventually can pay back the debt. If you do this, that you cut more than 25% of all science out of it, you are reducing the productivity, you are worsening the perspective of the French economy to ever recover. And so therefore you can see that the intention is to go back to a feudal economy, a feudal political system, reduce the population, and it's just insane. And this
and you see the effects of this in the unemployment rates, youth unemployment between 40% and 50%, and then there was this report this week that there are between 350,000 and 400,000 prostitutes in Spain. And it begins to make it look like maybe Dominique Strauss-Kahn is going to find another place to move to.
No, it's really a heartbreaking situation because, I mean, obviously, you know, the country of Spain is being, you know, it's like almost vultures trying to chew on a corpse, you know. And yeah. I think this will lead to a rebellion. I think this present government will be thrown out. And I think, you know, for me, somehow, you know, if you think that the EU has become very clearly an empire, I mean, Robert Cooper, who is the advisor of the so-called foreign minister of the EU, Lady Ashton, wrote extensively how the EU has become the empire with the largest territorial extension in history, and all the policies are empirical because, you know, they are supranational. They are basically the whole military policy goes in this direction. And for me, you know, the memory which comes up is that, you know, when Napoleon tried to turn, you know, his empire into an all-European empire by occupying Spain, large parts of Italy, Austria, Germany, Russia. Eventually, in Spain, the population started to rebel and go into a mode of resistance. And I think that that is really evoking parallels to this period. So my prediction is that this empire will not last for long, and the populations of all of these countries will rise up.
Well, let me come back to France again for a moment, because the Chaminade campaign does represent a very significant breakthrough of ideas, of Jacques' campaign slogan, France Without the City and Wall Street. You know, Helga, this has really happened very quickly, but it was something that you could see coming because of both the crisis and then also the work that was done with the mayors to put Jacques on the ballot. So it was clear that there was widespread support. The only question is whether it could be brought to the surface. I know Lynn was talking about this earlier today about the potential of the campaign. I'm not asking for a forecast or a prediction, but this is fundamentally changing politics in France, isn't it?
Yes, I would say so. And the funny thing is, you know, all the other candidates are really for this present system. Maybe the communists are on a different line, but all the other candidates, from the socialists to Sarkozy, to the Greens, to some of the other left candidates, in reality, they do not really propose a different conception. And Jacques, who, you know, emerged, you know, after he had already been in the race in 95, and there were tremendous operations thrown against him, you know, nevertheless, I mean, one of his main campaign videos is a clip where he, in 95, in the presidential campaign, said that the present financial system is irreversibly doomed and that the collapse will come soon. And he said, I will be ridiculized now, but later on, when the crisis hits, people will remember that I was the only one who was warning against it. And that is part of his present campaign material, which has been replayed by all kinds of mainstream TV stations. And that alone is already a big thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that he is talking about the issues which the population really is interested in,
right,
and not the media circus. The media tried to reduce the campaign to completely irrelevant issues like gay marriage, kindergarten places.
Well, and also things like who's electable, which is the issue in the United States.
Yeah, but Jacques from the beginning was saying this system is totally bankrupt and we need to have a future perspective, you know, which gives humanity and France, as part of that humanity, a perspective how to get out of the crisis by going back to the fundamental concepts of research and development, the whole question of space exploration. So he has shaped the French election campaign with these issues. He has, him only, nobody else, has introduced that Glass-Steagall is now a key issue. He has defended nuclear energy, which, you know, was also assaulted by several parties. And he has basically put the question of space policy on the agenda, which did not exist before. So the impact is for sure there. I think the minimum one can say is that he will be, and his movement will be, a big factor come next weekend. And then, you know, in the next couple of months, I think in June, there is the parliament election, so they will go fully on into that. So I think that France will be a different country, and I think it will spill over to Germany. It's already moving in Italy, where the former economic minister Giulio Tremonti came out with several blasts saying that the Monti government has completely failed and only a return to Glass-Steagall can get the country out of this crisis. So I wrote already last week an article saying that I can smell the winds of change with a memory. You know, I mean, the funny thing is, you know, I mean, when you get old enough to experience the collapse of one system and then 20 years later another collapse of another system, you can recognize the parallels. Now, obviously, 20 years ago, it was the collapse of the communist system, mm-hmm. East Germany, and then finally the whole Comecon collapsed. And, you know, I just was thinking that this situation right now has really parallels, because if you go back to the August of 1989, at that point it was clear that the East German economy was completely bankrupt. However, the political leadership of the DDR, the East German government, they were so-called concrete heads. That was what they were called. Honecker, for example, yeah. Erich Honecker at the 40th anniversary of the DDR made the famous speech where he said socialism will be here in 1,000 years and it will not be stopped by the donkey and not by the... anyway, he made some famous rhyme. And 3 weeks later, the wall came down.
Yeah.
Now, we have a situation where the governments of Europe today, who are pushing the ESM to be an eternity law, you know, Honecker talked only about 1,000 years, but here they want to have it for all eternity. but, you know, you have a situation when the governments and the main political institutions are completely separated from the processes which are going on in the population. Well, then it's a question of time when these regimes fall, and you know what will come out of it is unclear, but it will not last for long. But you will have either a break up into chaos and war, naturally, or you will have the potential for a real change. And I'm quite optimistic that we will be able to put the Glass-Steagall question on the table long before the election campaign in the United States comes up.
Well, this is you're listening to Helga Zepp LaRouche on The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, April 14th, 2012. We're 1 week away from the first round of the election in France. And Helga, this has been very useful, this review of the European, the transatlantic economic collapse. Can you make the connection now for our listeners? Because a lot of them are starting to realize they should do something. They're being activated by the slate of LaRouche candidates. They're getting involved in NWAPA. But I think it's important that they get the connection between this financial collapse and the British Empire's drive for war. So just if you can say a couple more words on that.
Well, you see, I mean, first of all, you know, people tend to agree that there is, in the history, in the previous centuries, you can many times trace a connection when a country or an empire is collapsing, that the establishment of such a country will try to change the agenda by going to a war against an enemy, and then, you know, the outside enemy is what unites the population mm-hmm. behind that government and so forth and so on. Now, this is obviously true, and there are always elements of that. But the real danger of the war comes, in my view, from a deeper lying reason, and mm-hmm. that is that, you know, the mythology says that World War I and World War II were caused by nation states fighting each other, and therefore nation states are bad and should be gotten rid of. In reality, all these world wars were the result of empires fighting each other. Like mm-hmm. in the First World War, it was the Austro-Hungarian, the Russian,
right.
The British, the German empires, and they basically fought. So it was empire. And today, where does the war danger come from today? Well, I already said that there is no question that the EU, in its conception, is trying to be an empire by, you know, the argument of their propaganda is to say, well, we have all these emerging giants in the world, China, India, Brazil, Russia may come back, America. So we have to be united and strong so that we can defend ourselves against these emerging monsters. And there were cartoons, you know, showing these monsters as gigantic bears and, you know.
yeah.
So, but in reality, I mean, if you really look at what was the dynamic in the period after the collapse of the Soviet Union, I mean, I particularly have made the point then, you know, that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the chance to establish a world peace order for mm-hmm. good, a peace order for the 21st century, because ostensibly there was no more enemy, so you didn't have to arm for some big confrontation. So you could have really said, okay, now communism is out and we can start to develop the world. And unfortunately, at that point, the British, Margaret Thatcher and Bush Senior, but especially in America, the neocons decided to go for the New America Century Doctrine mm-hmm. and build an empire based on the special relationship between Great Britain and the United States.
Right.
And the EU from Maastricht, the Maastricht Treaty onward, that is from 92 onward, basically aspired to become like the regional dependence of that global empire. And the Russians from the beginning, or at least, you know, later at the beginning of 2000 or so, I know from personal discussions I had, the Russians and also the Chinese looked at the NATO East expansion as an encirclement policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole European missile defense issue, which is now becoming a very big issue, was regarded as this encirclement policy. But also, you know, the whole question of recently the expansion of military alliances in Asia, the Chinese reacted very strongly against that, regarding it as an encirclement policy. And the Russians, from the beginning, looked at the EU Eastern European expansion as being essentially the same as the NATO expansion. And if you look at the interlocked treaties between the EU and NATO, then it's clear it's essentially one conglomerate, only separated by emphasis a little bit, but they have so many military agreements that it's really one.
Well, and the Russian point from the beginning was that if NATO was there to counteract the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet bloc, now that there's no longer a Soviet bloc, why do you still need NATO?
Exactly. And they were never offered to be part of any agreement, which they took as an expression of mistrust. Now, that is what is the danger, that as long as all these European countries are in this kind of a conglomerate, by the logic, if, for example, it would come to a strike against Iran, and that issue has not yet been diffused, as you know, despite mm-hmm. the fact that General Dempsey and many Israeli military and intelligence leaders have warned against it, that issue is not off the table. And, you know, the recent eruption around the so-called poem by the German Nobel Prize winner Günter Grass,
mm-hmm.
Who made a prose text, which he called a poem, which, you know, I don't regard as a poem. But in any case, he said the danger is that out of such a military strike against Iran, there could come World War III, mm-hmm. killing millions of people. And that has caused a complete explosion. But there you have it again. You know, the difference between the mainstream media, many of them attacking him, and the population, and now slowly more organizations, they all say, wait a second, maybe it was not the most, you know, perfect way to address it. But the reality of the matter is there is a danger of World War III, mm-hmm. and we better discuss that. So looking at the whole thing, his poem had a very important effect because it brought to the awareness of the masses of the population that we are on the verge of World War III. And, you know, there was a statement by the present head of the security conference in Munich, Wolfgang Ischinger, already 2 months ago, where he said, you know, that there must be a debate in Germany about the implication of Mrs. Merkel's famous speech in the Knesset in 2008, where she said that the raison d'être, the state reason of Germany, is totally tied with the defense of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he said that in a moment when Israel is talking about a preemptive attack on Iran, you know, that makes Germany hostage to such an attack, and therefore we have to have a public debate. Now, Günter Grass has managed to get that public debate wide
<That's>
open.
Right.
I think that is what, you know, is not diffused, and the danger is absolutely there. So, you know, the war danger comes, you know, not from Israel as such, because, you know, I don't think Israel is, you know, a country which would seriously, I mean, half of the population in Israel does not want that war. The majority...
Even the Israeli military and Mossad, the intelligence community, have been backing up what General Dempsey said about that Iran does not have a nuclear weapon, they're not building it, there's no reason to launch an attack.
Yes, exactly. So, therefore, I think what the other development, which, what you mentioned in the beginning, I think is very, very important, and that is that at the occasion of the Russian Cosmonaut Day, yeah, which is the anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's first space travel, which was on the 12th of April, there is a very important Russian website called TerraAmericana.ru. They made an interview with my husband, Lyndon LaRouche, asking him about, why he thought that the space programs in the United States and Russia were not on the level they should be, and what about the SDE, the Strategic Defense of the Earth. Now, this is very, very important because, yeah, you see, I mean, we have to, the only way how we will get out of this crisis, both the danger of World War III and the danger of a hyperinflationary collapse of the financial system and the potential explosion of a meltdown of the system, the only way how we will get out of this system is we have to have a complete change in the axioms. As long as we stay in the realm of monetarism, of geostrategic conflict of interest, all of these attributes which belong to the thinking of an empire, the catastrophe is pre-programmed. And therefore, what we need to do, we have to basically go to a completely set of different axioms which are in cohesion with the real laws of the universe. Mm-hmm. And that is that, the universe is there. It's a beautiful universe. I think we should really study the universe because, I agree with Kepler, who said the more you study the harmonies of the universe and the lawfulness, the more you see that there must be a loving creator who did all of that. Mm-hmm. And the funny and totally fascinating thing is that especially in these days and weeks, whatever is left of space research, all these satellites and excursions into space, they are bringing back documentation for the first time with modern equipment that the universe is expanding in an anti-entropic way, that it is developing, and that creativity is the principle of the actual development of the universe. Now, this is beautiful because this confirms what Nicolaus of Cus already recognized theoretically, philosophically, ontologically in the 15th century, namely that human creativity, the microcosm, and the actual development of the physical universe, the macrocosm, are obeying the same laws. And mm-hmm. the law of the universe and the law of the human mind are identical, the principle of creativity. Now, this is something, which must become the focus of the common aims of mankind. And that is not just an academic question or something you can entertain or not, but it becomes an existential question because right now the evidence is becoming overwhelming that our little planet, which is a tiny planet in a huge solar system within billions of solar systems, within billions of galaxies, just to have this vision that we are just a tiny, tiny planet in this unbelievably big universe, which is expanding, which is developing, which is obeying certain cyclical developments. And therefore, you cannot discuss anything on this Earth without taking into effect and into account that we are part of this universe at large. And we have to understand the laws of this universe, because if we don't, we will have no better fate than you know, previous species in the history of evolution on the Earth, which were not intelligent enough to make the next jump to a higher development, like the dinosaurs. And, you know, we are right now confronted with clear effects from the galaxy on our planet.
Just this weekend, there's warnings of extreme tornadoes coming through from Texas up through the Midwest. But to get to your point, I think, on this, the significance of this dialogue between your husband and the Russians, the headline on the website of the article is, "The clear intention of the British Empire is to break off space exploration." And I think this is really an indication of the quality of dialogue that's taking place and the potential that's inherent in it, both for what you're talking about in terms of the great cosmic issues as well as the political fight on this planet.
Yeah, and I think it is very important that, you know, what is coming up in this interview, and there are probably more things to come in the future, that the Russian interviewer pick up on the question of the SDE, mm-hmm. the Strategic Defense of Earth,
right.
Because that is in a direct history and continuity to the proposal of the SDI, which Lynn made. Actually, you know, the beginning of this proposal was already in 1977, mm-hmm. Which was the idea that both superpowers should get rid of nuclear weapons altogether by making them technologically obsolete by developing a defense being less costly than the offensive, namely the whole question of laser weapons, of weapons of based on new physical principles. And, you know, if the Soviets at that point would have accepted that proposal, the whole history would have taken a different direction, and the Soviet Union may have been transformed, but they may not have been collapsing. So since there are many people from this period in the science area, in the military-industrial complex, who are very familiar with the proposals of Lin, I find it very, very remarkable that they now come to this question, you know, because only if you change the agenda and say, how can Russia, the United States, China, Europe, how can they really unite on fending off those threats, which are a threat to all of us, only then can we come out of this present petty conflict, which, you know, is really petty if you look at it as the large, mm-hmm. from the standpoint of the large course of history.
Well, Helga, we're just down to about a little more than seven minutes, and I want to bring up one other topic, which is something that you have done a lot of historical research on and have consistently been a voice warning of these kinds of dangers, and that is the move in the United States to what your husband is calling a Hitler coup by Obama, which, if you look at it over the period of the last couple of years, it includes his assertion of the right of the president to be judge, jury, and executioner, ordering the killing of Americans, and not just Americans, but of civilians in Pakistan and elsewhere, his orders that were included in the National Defense Authorization Act for indefinite detention of American citizens based on secret documents and secret evidence never presented with due process, his violating the Constitution on war doctrine, where only the Congress can declare war, and his challenge to Congress was, I'm going to do this and you get out of my way. And now the most recent, his completely provocative statement that the Supreme Court has no right to overturn legislation that's passed, which is precisely the reason the Supreme Court was set up, to overturn legislation that's unconstitutional. This has, he's repeating what was the enabling legislation for the Hitler dictatorship from Carl Schmitt, where it says that the leader is justice, is above the balances of power, the checks and balances, and so on. So I'd like you to just say something about that from looking at this situation, both from the historical perspective and this present crisis.
Well, I think the issue of Carl Schmitt is really the crucial thing, because as I said earlier, the developments of trying to undo the American Constitution by the sequence of developments you just emphasized, and what is happening with the European Union, ESM, fiscal union dictatorship, they always argue with emergency, that the reason why you cannot go through the due parliamentarian or congressional process is because of emergency. And that is exactly what happened in Germany with these enabling laws, that, you know, you can basically undo any constitution with that argument. And I think there needs to be a discussion about that, about Carl Schmitt. And actually, I'm really a little bit shocked that all of these congressmen and senators, with very few exceptions, actually, I think there are three exceptions, who have not really acted on that. And what is being right now in danger is the American Constitution itself. And that is something very precious, because the American Constitution, from all the constitutions I know about and I've looked at, and I did look at all of them, or at least the most important ones, it's the most important document of state law on this earth, and it needs to be defended. And, you know, because if you don't have the Constitution anymore, then lawlessness, dictatorship, and all of these things are, you know, limitless there. And, you know, fortunately now, at least the American Bar Association chairman came out recently by, you know, noting the fact that this attack on the Supreme Court, that there would be non-elected people, is a completely ridiculous argument, because by the very nature of the design of the division of powers, the Supreme Court is not supposed to be elected, and it's supposed to be the check and balance of both the presidency and the Congress.
Right.
So at least one voice representing, however, 400,000 lawyers in America has spoken out. But, you know, that's not really enough. It's a drop on a hot stone, but at least it's something. I think the fact that now the blogosphere and internet community has a new a movie in the form of the documentation or the 10-minute video by Sean Stone being on the Alex Jones show. I think this is very important. And other people have made similar statements, like Wayne Madsen. So I think that there is an awakening going on. But I think the most important is really that people appreciate how important the American Constitution is. You know, we have talked about that in the past many times, that when the European monarchies and, you know, basically oligarchical forces prevented a republic to come into being, many people from Europe before the time of the American Revolution, during it and even afterwards, immigrated to the United States because they regarded America as the place where you could have a republic. And in these years and centuries, America was regarded as a beacon of hope and a temple of liberty by every patriotic and republican force around the world. And I think Americans should have the absolute pride to go back to this tradition, because people want to be friends with America, but they don't want to be subdued by wars and empire, but they want to be allied with the America of the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence, the ideas which, you know, are embedded in the American Constitution. And that is about to be lost. So Americans must really start to fight and, you know, do what Lincoln did, who revived this tradition, do what Franklin D. Roosevelt did and Martin Luther King. They always would go back to the Declaration of Independence, to the Constitution. And that is the proud identity of Americans, which right now is in big danger.
Helga, regrettably, we're out of time, but I would call our listeners' attention to a short video statement you did as a message to Americans, which is on the LaRouchePAC.com website. And much of what Helga has discussed today is available in various bits and pieces on the website. But this has been, I think, very important. And I just want to reiterate the point you're making about forcing the discussion into the open of what it means when we have a president who is openly violating the principles of the Constitution. If that's not enough to get Americans to start organizing to back up the LaRouche candidate slate, to take this up in your churches, your schools, your workplaces, then we really will lose the country. And as Helga has just pointed out, that would be a tragic loss for civilization and for all of history. So Helga, thank you very much for joining us today. And we'll be back next Saturday with another edition of The LaRouche Show.
I would like to just say one last word.
Go ahead.
This European Union, European Monetary Union, euro system is to shatter shortly. And that is the moment when there must be a Glass-Steagall legislation. So all the people who think they can postpone reviving of Glass-Steagall until after the election, I can forewarn you, reality will intervene and the Glass-Steagall must be put on the agenda now if you want to prevent that the collapse of the European system is bringing down all the American banks and chaos will reign. So get mobilized now. The time for Glass-Steagall is now.
Okay, you heard it from Helga Zepp LaRouche, and with that we'll close the program and talk to you again next week.